"Chater runs a choice establishment," Littlefinger said as they rode. "I've half a mind to buy it. Brothels are a much sounder investment than ships, I've found. Whores seldom sink, and when they are boarded by pirates, why, the pirates pay good coin like everyone else." Lord Petire chuckled at his own wit. Ned let him prattle on. After a time, he quieted, and they rode in silence. The streets of King's Landing were dark and deserted. The rain had driven everyone under their roofs. It beat down on Ned's head, warm as blood and relentless as old guilts. Fat drops of water ran down his face. "Robert would never keep to one bed," Lyanna had told him at Winterfell, on the night long ago, when their father had promised her hand to the young lord of Storm's End. "I hear he has gotten a child on some girl in the Vale." Ned had held the babe in his arms. He could scarcely deny her, nor would he lie to his sister. But he had assured her that what Robert did before their betrothal was of no matter, that he was a good man, and true, who would love her with all his heart. Lyanna had only smiled. "Love is sweet, dearest Ned, but it cannot change a man's nature." The girl had been so young. Ned had not dared to ask her age. No doubt she'd been a virgin. The better brothels could always find a virgin if the purse was fat enough. She had light red hair with a powdering of freckles across the bridge of her nose, and when she slipped free a breast to give her nipple to the babe, he saw that her bosom was freckled as well. "I named her Barra," she said, as the child nurse. "She looks so like him, does she not, my lord? She has his nose and his hair." "She does," Eddard Stark had touched the baby's fine dark hair. It flowed through his fingers like black silk. Robert's firstborn had had the same fine hair, he seemed to recall. "Tell him that when you see him, my lord, as it please you. Tell him how beautiful she is." "I will," Ned had promised her. That was his curse. Robert would swear on dying love and forget them before evenfall. But Ned Stark kept his vows. He thought of the promises he'd made Lyanna as she lay dying, and the price he'd paid to keep them.
"And tell him I've not been with no one else. I swear it, my lord, by the old gods and you. Shataya said I could have half a year for the baby and for hoping he'd come back. So you'll tell him I'm waiting, won't you? I don't want no jewels or nothing, just him. He was always good to me, truly."
"Good to you," Ned thought hollowly. "I will tell him, child, and I promise you, Barra shall not go wanting." She had smiled then, a smile so tremulous and sweet that it cut the heart out of him. Riding through the rainy night, Ned saw Jon Snow's face in front of him, so like the younger version of his own. If the gods frowned so on bastards, he thought dully, why did they fill men with such lusts? "Lord Baelish, what do you know of Robert's bastards?"
"Well, he has more than you, for a start."
"How many?"
Littlefinger shrugged. Rivulets of moisture twisted down the back of his cloak. "Does it matter? If you bed enough women, some will give you presents, and his grace has never been shy on that count. I know he's acknowledged that boy at Storm's End, the one he fathered the night Lord Stannis wed. He could hardly do otherwise. The mother was a Florent, niece to Lady Selyse, one of her bedmaids. Renly says that Robert carried the girl upstairs during the feast, and broke in the wedding bed while Stannis and his bride were still dancing. Lord Stannis seemed to think that was a blot on the honour of his wife's house, so when the boy was born, he shipped him off to Renly." He gave Ned a sideways glance. "I've also heard whispers that Robert got a pair of twins on a serving wench at Casterly Rock 3 years ago when he went west for Lord Tywin's tourney. Cersei had the babes killed, and sold the mother to a passing slaver. Too much an affront to Lannister pride, that close to home." Ned Stark grimaced. Ugly tales like that were told of every great lord in the realm. He could believe it as Cersei Lannister readily enough, but would the king stand by and let it happen? The Robert he had known would not have, but the Robert he had known had never been so practiced at shutting his eyes to things he did not wish to see. Why would John Arryn take a sudden interest in the king's base-born children? The short man gave a sudden shrug. He was the king's hand. Doubtless, Robert asked him to see they were provided for. Ned was soaked through to the bone, and his soul had grown cold. It had to be more than that, or why kill him? Littlefinger shook the rein from his hair and laughed. Now I see. Lord Arryn learned that his grace had filled the bellies of some whores and fishwives, and for that he had to be silenced. Small wonder. Allow a man like that to live, and next he's likely to blurt out that the sun rises in the east. There was no answer Ned Stark could give to that but a frown. For the first time in years he found himself remembering Rhaegar Targaryen. He wondered if Rhaegar had frequented brothels. Somehow he thought not. The rain was falling harder now, stinging the eyes and drumming against the ground. Rivers of black water were running down the hill when Jory called out, "My lord!" His voice hoarse with alarm. And in an instant the street was full of soldiers. Ned glimpsed ringmail over leather, gauntlets and greaves, steel helms with golden lions on the crests. Their cloaks clung to their backs sudden with rain. He had no time to count, but there were 10 at least, a line of them, on foot, blocking the street, with long swords and iron-tipped spears. "Behind!" he heard Will cry, and when he turned his horse, there were more in back of them, cutting off their retreat. Jory's sword came singing from its scabbard. "Make way or die!" "The wolves are howling," their leader said. Ned could see rain running down his face. Such a small pack, though. Littlefinger walked his horse forward, step by careful step. "What is the meaning of this?" "This is the hand of the king." He was the hand of the king. The mud muffled the hooves of the blood-bathed stallion. The lion parted before him. On a golden breastplate, the Lion of Lannister roared its defiance. Now, if truth be told, I'm not sure what is. "Lannister, this is madness," Littlefinger said. "Let us pass. We're expected back at the castle. What do you think you're doing?" "He knows what he's doing," Ned said calmly. Jaime Lannister smiled. "Quite true. I'm looking for my brother. You remember my brother, don't you, Lord Stark? He was with us at Winterfell. Fair-haired, mismatched eyes, sharp of tongue, a short man." "I remember him well," Ned replied. "It would seem he has met some trouble on the road. My lord father is quite vexed. You would not perchance have any notion of who might have wished my brother ill, would you? Your brother has been taken at my command to answer for his crimes," Ned Stark said. Littlefinger groaned in dismay. "Oh, my lords!" Sir Jaime ripped the longsword from his sheath and urged his stallion forward. "Show me your steel, Lord Eddard. I'll butcher you like Ares if I must. But I'd sooner you died with a blade in your hand." He gave Littlefinger a cool, contemptuous glance. "Lord Baelish, I'd leave here in some haste if I did not care to get bloodstains on my costly clothing." Littlefinger did not need to be urged. "I will bring the city watch," he promised Ned. The Lannister line parted to let him through, and closed behind him. Littlefinger put his heels to his mare and vanished around a corner. Ned's men had drawn their swords, but there were 3 against 20. Eyes watched from nearby windows and doors, but no one was about to intervene. His party was mounted, the Lannisters on foot, save for Jaime himself. A charge might win them free, but it seemed to Eddard Stark that they had a surer, safer tactic. "Kill me," he warned the Kingslayer, "and Catelyn will most certainly slay Tyrion." Jaime Lannister poked at Ned's chest with a gilded sword that had sipped the blood of the last of the Dragon Kings. "Would she?" The noble Catelyn Tully of Riverrun murder a hostage? I think not, he sighed. But I am not willing to chance my brother's life on a woman's honour. Jaime slid the golden sword into its sheath. So I suppose I'll let you run back to Robert to tell him how I've frightened you. I wonder if he'll care. Jaime pushed his wet hair back with his fingers and wheeled his horse around. When he was beyond the line of swordsmen, he glanced back at his captain. Tregar, see that no harm comes to Lord Stark. As you say, my lord. Still, we wouldn't want him to leave here entirely unchastened, so... Through the night and the rain, he glimpsed the white of Jaime's smile. Kill his men. No! Ned Stark screamed, clawing for his sword. Jaime was already cantering off down the street as he heard Will shout. Men closed from both sides. Ned rode one down, cutting at phantoms in red cloaks who gave way before him. Jorah Cassel put his heels into his mount and charged. A steel-shod hoof caught a Lannister guardsman in the face with a sickening crunch. A second man reeled away, and for an instant Jorah was free. Will cursed as they pulled him off his dying horse, sword slashing in the rain. Ned galloped to him, bringing his longsword down on Tregar's helm. The jolt of impact made him grit his teeth. Tregar stumbled to his knees, his lion crest sheared in half, blood running down his face. Hewitt was hacking at the hands that had seized his bridle, when a spear caught him in the belly. Suddenly Jorah was back among them, a red rain flying from his sword. No! Ned shouted. Jorah, away! Ned's horse slipped under him and came crashing down in the mud. There was a moment of blinding pain and the taste of blood in his mouth. He saw them cut the legs from Jorah's mount and drag him to the earth, swords rising and falling as they closed in around him. When Ned's horse lurched back to its feet, he tried to rise, but only to fall again, choking on his scream. He could see the splintered bone poking through his calf. It was the last thing he saw for a time. The rain came down, and down, and down. When he opened his eyes again, Lord Eddard Stark was alone with his dead. His horse moved closer, caught the rank smell of blood, and galloped away. Ned began to drag himself through the mud, gritting his teeth at the agony in his leg. It seemed to take years. Faces watched from candlelit windows, and people began to emerge from alleys and doors, but no one moved to help. Littlefinger and the city watch found him there in the street, cradling Jorah Cassel's body in his arms. Somewhere the gold cloaks found a litter, but the trip back to the castle was a blur of agony, and Ned lost consciousness more than once. He remembered seeing the Red Keep looming ahead of him in the first grey light of dawn. The rain had darkened the pale pink stone of the massive walls to the colour of blood. Then Grand Maester Pycelle was looming over him, holding a cup, whispering, "Drink, my lord, here, the milk of the poppy, for your pain." He remembered swallowing, and Pycelle was telling someone to heat the wine to boiling and fetch him clean silk, and that was the last he knew. Daenerys. The horse gate of Aes Dothrak was made of two gigantic bronze stallions, rearing, their hooves meeting 100 feet above the roadway to form a pointed arch. Daenerys could not have said why the city needed a gate when it had no walls and no buildings that she could see, yet there it stood, immense and beautiful, the great horses framing the distant purple mountain beyond. The bronze stallions threw long shadows across the waving grasses as Khal Drogo led the Khalasar under their hooves and down the God's Way, his blood riders beside him. Dany followed on her silver, escorted by Ser Jorah Mormont, and her brother Viserys mounted once more. After the day in the grass, when she had left him to walk back to the Khalasar, the Dothraki had laughingly called him Khal-Re-Mar, the Sore-Foot King. Khal Drogo had offered him a place in a cart the next day, and Viserys had accepted. In his stubborn ignorance, he had not even known he was being mocked. The carts were for eunuchs, cripples, women giving birth, the very young and the very old. That won him yet another name, Khal Ragat, the Cart King. Her brother had thought it was the Khal's way of apologizing for the wrong Danny had done him. She had begged Ser Jorah not to tell him the truth, lest he be shamed. The knight had replied that the king could well do with a bit of shame. Yet he had done as she bid. It had taken much pleading, and all the pillow tricks Doria had taught her, before Danny had been able to make Drogo relent and allow Viserys to rejoin them at the head of the column. "Where is the city?" she asked, as they passed underneath the bronze arch. There were no buildings to be seen, no people, only the grass and the road, lined with ancient monuments from all the lands the Dothraki had sacked over the centuries. "Ahead," Ser Jorah answered, "under the mountain." Beyond the horse gate, plundered guards and stolen heroes loomed on either side of them. The forgotten deities of dead cities brandished their broken thunderbolts at the sky as Danny rode her silver past their feet. Stoned kings looked down on her from their thrones, their faces chipped and stained, even their names lost in the mists of time. Lithe young maidens danced on marble plinths draped only in flowers or poured air from shattered jars. Monsters stood in the grass beside the road, black iron dragons with jewels for eyes, roaring griffins, manticores with their barbed tails poised to strike, and other beasts she could not name. Some of the statues were so lovely they took her breath away, others so misshapen and terrible that Danny could scarcely bear to look at them. Those, Ser Jorah said, had likely come from the shadowlands beyond the Ashai. "So many," she said, as her silver stepped slowly onward, "and from so many lands." Viserys was less impressed. "The trash of dead cities," he sneered. He was careful to speak in the common tongue, which few Dothraki could understand. Yet even so, Danny found herself glancing back at the men in her cars to make sure he had not been overheard. He went on bitterly, "All these savages know how to do is steal things better men have built and kill." He laughed. "Oh, they do know how to kill. Otherwise, I'd have no use for them at all." "They are my people now," Danny said. "You should not call them savages, brother." "The dragon speaks as he likes," Viserys said, in the common tongue. He glanced over his shoulder at Aego and Ricaro riding behind them, and favored them with a mocking smile. "See, the savages lack the wit to understand the speech of civilized men." A moss-eaten stone monolith loomed over the road, 50 feet tall. Viserys glanced at it with boredom in his eyes. "How long must we linger amongst these ruins before Drogo gives me my army? I grow tired of waiting." "The princess must be presented to the Dushkaleen." "The Kerns, yes," her brother interrupted. "And there's to be some mummer's show of a prophecy for the whelp in her belly, you tell me. What is that to me? I'm tired of eating horse meat, and I'm sick of the stink of these savages." He sniffed at the wide, floppy sleeves of his tunic, where it was his custom to keep a sachet. It could not have helped much. The tunic was filthy. All the silk and heavy wools that Viserys had worn out of Pentos were stained by hard travel and rotted from sweat. Ser Jorah Mormont said, "The Western Market will have food more to your taste, Your Grace. The traders from the free cities come there to sell their wares. The Khal will honour his promise in his own time." "He had better," Viserys said grimly. "I was promised a crown, and I mean to have it. The dragon is not mocked." Spying an obscene likeness of a woman with six breasts and a ferret's head, he rode off to inspect it more closely. Danny was relieved, yet no less anxious. "I pray that my sun and stars will not keep him waiting too long," she told Sir Jorah, when her brother was out of earshot. The knight looked after Viserys doubtfully. "Your brother should have bided his time in Pentos. There's no place for him in a Khalasar. Illyrio tried to warn him." "He will go as soon as he has his 10,000. My lord husband promised a golden crown." Sir Jorah granted.
"Yes, Khaleesi, but the Dothraki look on these things differently than we do in the West. I have told him as much, as Illyria told him, but your brother does not listen. The horse lords are no traders. Viserys thinks he sold you, and now he wants his price, yet Khal Drogo would say he had you as a gift. He will give Viserys a gift in return, yes, in his own time. You do not demand a gift, not of a Khal. You do not demand anything of a Khal."
It's not right to make him wait. Danny did not know why she was defending her brother, yet she was. "Viserys says he could sweep the Seven Kingdoms with 10,000 Dothraki screamers." Sir Jorah snorted. "Viserys could not sweep a stable with 10,000 brooms." Danny could not pretend to surprise at the disdain in his tone. What if it were not Viserys, she asked. If it were someone else who led them, someone stronger, could the Dothraki truly conquer the Seven Kingdoms? Sir Jorah's face grew thoughtful as their horses trod together down the God's Way.
"When I first went into exile, I looked at the Dothraki and saw half-naked barbarians, as wild as their horses. If you'd asked me then, Princess, I should have told you that 1,000 good knights would have no trouble putting to flight 100 times as many Dothraki."
"But if I asked you now?"
"Now," the knight said, "I'm less certain. They're better riders than any knight, utterly fearless, and their bows outrange ours. In the Seven Kingdoms, most archers fight on foot, from behind a shield wall or a barricade of sharpened stakes. The Dothraki fire from horseback, charging or retreating, it makes no matter. They are full as deadly. And there are so many of them, my lady. Your lord husband alone counts 40,000 mounted warriors in his Khalasar."
"Is that truly so many? Your brother Rhaegar brought as many men to the Trident," Sir Jorah admitted. "But of that number, no more than a tenth were knights. The rest were archers, free riders, and foot soldiers armed with spears and pikes. When Rhaegar fell, many threw down their weapons and fled the field. How long do you imagine such a rabble would stand against a charge of 40,000 screamers howling for blood? How well would boiled leather jerkins and mail shirts protect them when the arrows fall like rain?"
"Not long," she said. "Not well." He nodded. "Mind you, Princess, if the lords of the Seven Kingdoms have the wit the gods gave a goose, it will never come to that. The riders have no taste for siegecraft. I doubt they could take even the weakest castle in the Seven Kingdoms. But if Robert Baratheon were fool enough to give them battle..."
"Is he?" Danny asked. "A fool, I mean." Sir Jorah considered that for a moment.
"Robert should have been born Dothraki," he said at last. "Your Khal will tell you that only a coward hides behind stone walls instead of facing his enemy with a blade in hand. The usurper would agree. He's a strong man, brave, and rash enough to meet a Dothraki horde in the open field. But the men around him, well, their pipers play a different tune. His brother Stannis, Lord Tywin Lannister, Eddard Stark..." He spat.
"You hate this Lord Stark?" Danny said.
"He took from me all that I loved, for the sake of a few lice-ridden poachers and his precious honor," Sir Jorah said bitterly.
From his tone, she could tell the lust still pained him. He changed the subject quickly.
"There," he announced, pointing, "Vaes Dothrak, the city of the horse lords."
Khal Drogo and his blood riders led them through the great bazaar of the Western Market, down the broad ways beyond. Danny followed, close on her silver, staring at the strangeness about her. Vaiz Dothrak was at once the largest city and the smallest that she had ever known. She thought it must be 10 times as large as Pentos, a vastness without walls or limits, its broad, wind-swept streets paved in grass and mud and carpeted with wild flowers. In the free cities of the West, towers and manses and hovels and bridges and shops and halls all crowded in on one another. But Vaiz Dothrak sprawled languorously, baking in the warm sun, ancient, arrogant, and empty. Even the buildings were so queer to her eyes. She saw carved stone pavilions, manses of woven grass as large as castles, rickety wooden towers, stepped pyramids faced with marble, log halls open to the sky.